But Canadian wildfire haze in the air throughout the day, a high of 76. Right now, humidity 74%, 62 in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It is 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. One of my all-time favorite interviews on the morning show regarding a sports topic happened way back in 2009, maybe 2010, when I spoke with a sports writer by the name of John Eisenberg about a fantastic book called The First Season, That First Season, How Vince Lombardi Took the Worst Team in the NFL and Set It on a Path to Glory. He told the story that is largely unknown, even amongst Packer fans, about just how bad the Packers were before Vince Lombardi came aboard and set that ship aright and took them into NFL history. I am so happy to be able to reconnect with John Eisenberg about yet another fantastic book called The Streak, Lou Gehrig, Cal Ripken Jr., and Baseball's Most Historic Record. We are talking about a Major League Baseball record that stood for many decades, set by Lou Gehrig, playing in 2,130 games without interruption. Actually, as many people know, until he himself took himself out of the lineup as the symptoms of ALS, at that point not yet diagnosed, began to undercut his magnificent abilities on the diamond. Nevertheless, he lasted 2,130 games, and it was a record that stood unequaled for many years until it was finally broken by Cal Ripken Jr., a star for the Baltimore Orioles. In this fascinating book, John Eisenberg looks at these two exemplary baseball players and their place in the record books, but also looks at the phenomenon of the streak itself through the history of baseball, helping us understand at what point such a thing became something to even notice and celebrate, and some of the great ball players who have also managed to achieve very, very impressive streaks. He also raises some intriguing questions that have sometimes been raised by the media along the way. Is this sort of a record a selfish sort of record? Because is it sometimes a case of a player safeguarding their streak at the expense of their team when that player might be going through a rough patch or a serious slump or whatever, in which their best place might be on the bench? A lot of intriguing questions come up, and by the end of it, we find ourselves relishing this great American game all over again. The book again called The Streak, Lou Gehrig, Cal Ripken Jr., and Baseball's Most Historic Record. And John Eisenberg, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you remembering one of my former books, and I'm glad to be with you again.
I'm really happy to have this opportunity to speak with you. I loved that book about the Packers, and I loved this book every bit as much. Usually I would ask some sort of question about why did it occur to you to write this particular book, or when did you become aware of this particular story, because you are someone who has covered the Baltimore Orioles and all sports in Baltimore for many, many years. That's actually a question I really don't need to bother asking. I suppose anybody who has lived in and around Baltimore knows all about this streak. But perhaps you didn't know until you began researching this book just what a rich story this would be beyond these two exemplary ballplayers, Cal Ripken and Lou Gehrig.
Well, you've hit it right on the head. Very good, because, yes, my original idea was, having lived through the Ripken streak and written about it extensively, my original idea was to hold it up to the light with Gehrig's and compare them. I thought that would be very interesting because the streaks, even though it's the same achievement in the same game, ostensibly by the same rules, but so different in every way almost. When you think about it, Gehrig played every minute of his career in the heat of the day, summer, you know, in the light of day. Never played a minute of night baseball. Ripken, of course, played thousands of games at night, but Ripken also played on artificial turf, something that Gehrig never played on, much, much harder on Cal. There are just many, many ways to compare these records, and I thought it would be really interesting to dive into that, but almost as soon as I started doing that, I realized I can't tell the story of these streaks and how they were attained in these two men without telling the story of this curious record that you described so well, because it is just an odd record. I can't think of another one where, I mean, if you hit a bunch of home runs, people just cheer for you and say that's a great achievement. Or if you strike out thousands of batters or whatever it may be, people applaud. I mean, they still applaud at Gehrig and Ripken for playing these games, but there's always an undercurrent of people saying, why are you doing that? You know, is it, who cares? Some people say, even, I mean, that's what Babe Ruth said to Lou Gehrig. Who cares? So I realized I had to really dig deep, tell the whole story of the record, and it became a much larger assignment and a more interesting one, I thought. So it took me back to the very beginning of baseball, through modern times, really, through today. So a large task. It took me 4.5 years to complete it, once it was over, I had a pretty large. I had put these two streaks in context.
Right, absolutely, and we all applaud you for it. That's no small feat, and I appreciate the fact too that your book by no means begins with Lou Gehrig. You set this in a longer, wider historical context as well. Although it's certainly true that the keeping of statistics was, in a sense, much spottier in the 19th century. And even so, we can look back to the 19th century to the first ball player to achieve an impressive streak. Tell us about this interesting gentleman by the name of George Pinckney.
George Pinckney, baseball's first Iron Man, played for Brooklyn. We're going so far back, they weren't even the Brooklyn Dodgers. They were called the Brooklyn Bridegrooms because several of the players got married one offseason. And they said, oh, well, we'll call them the Bridegrooms. So it was a little more casual about nicknames back then. But anyway, Pinckney was the third baseman, and he played without a glove. So this is really the early days of baseball. And he was sort of a stalwart. I mean, it's much like what Ripken and Gehrig attained decades later. No one quantified it, though. They just knew, as you said, the statistical apparatus, which I detail in the book, was very unsophisticated, mistake-ridden, prehistoric, really. So they just knew he was dependable. They didn't know he played in so many games in a row. And I certainly didn't know the number. But he did. It was when the first generation of serious statisticians came along in the early 1900s that they were able to ascertain that he played in 578 straight games, making him the first Iron Man.
Do I remember that he is a player renowned for having played at least one game without a glove?
Oh, he definitely played without a glove, played a lot of games without gloves. Yeah, he was a little portly, little third baseman who was just sort of good with the. He was a contact hitter, very good defensively, but yeah, without a glove. But that was actually common back then. It was just when he was playing, it was just becoming evident that maybe people should play with gloves.
Right.
It might be better.
Right.
And so,
and the point, really, of course, is that to play 578 games consecutively with the sort of primitive equipment of the day says something about his toughness and really the toughness of everybody who played baseball back then.
Without a doubt. Of course, as I detail in the book, it was a pretty wild time in Major League Baseball. Players were not exactly looked upon as the highest form of, the highest level of society, and there was a fair amount of drinking going on and carousing. And I think what really made people proud of him is that he didn't show up. He was sober enough to play every day, so that there was definitely a small aspect of that going on as well.
Right. The ball player who ended up breaking Pinckney's record, and he did it in pretty spectacular fashion, is a player that very few people remember today. It's a name that was completely unfamiliar to me, Everett Scott. He broke Pinckney's record, if I remember right, back in 1920. Tell us more about him, and what about him made him the man to break this record?
Well, and what's interesting about Everett Scott is that if you lined up 100 players from that era and said, pick out the Iron Man, he would be number 100, probably, that you would pick. Everett Scott was a little 120-pound shortstop for the Red Sox and Yankees during and after World War I, played with Babe Ruth in both cities, and just with bug eyes and jug ears and a chronic case of the boils. He had to wrap himself before every game. So really kind of the schoolyard wimp, you know. But he was a really strong fielding shortstop, and somehow got it into his head that he could play. He wanted to just play every day. That was how he could contribute, putting his defense on the field every day. And so he was able to do it, and he was the one that really brought the idea into the light. And, yes, he passed Pinckney and went on to play in 1,307 straight games. And like Pinckney, and then like Gehrig, Ripken later, he was kind of an All-American image. That is definitely a current running through the history of this streak. His teammates called him the Deacon because he got up and went to church on Sundays. And let's just say that not all of them did.
And of course, as you've maybe already touched on, he was very conscious of this streak. This was something he wanted to accomplish, and got it in his head that it would really be cool if he managed to play in 1,000 consecutive games, and he managed to do that. So this is a case of someone who wasn't just a grinder who kind of accidentally or absentmindedly happened to break this record. I mean, this meant a lot to him.
It meant a lot to him, and yes, that the real goal for him was 1,000. And when he reached 1,000, it was something new in baseball, and it received a lot of attention. I came across front page. I mean, it was blared across the top of the Sporting News, which was really the Bible for baseball back then. Pictures and articles and a big thing, and they had a big. It was in Washington, and they had a huge ceremony with the Secretary of the Navy there, and it was a big, big deal. Christian Science Monitor, I found a column written about baseball, about Everett Scott being a dependable guy who could play every day and how fans could relate to that. This is decades before Gehrig and Ripken sort of became famous for the same reason. So Everett Scott really created the mold of the Iron Man that would become so famous.
Is he the player where you tell the story about him preserving the streak one day when the trains got stopped? Is that Everett Scott? Do you want to tease our
Everett
listeners
Scott
with that story?
He was about 20 games short of 1,000, and he was out in the Yankees had taken the train to Indiana. I'm sorry, to Chicago to play the White Sox. He hopped off in Indiana because that's where he lived. His wife was there. Spent the night with his wife and figured he could get up early the next day and take a train on into Chicago. Well, the train blew a cylinder at like 6 in the morning on the track and was just sitting there, and he was in big trouble at that point. And so Yes, there was this long escapade, something out of a movie where he talks to a farmer. He goes and runs across a field, knocks on a farmer's door. The farmer lets him use the phone. He talks a cab dispatcher into coming to get him, and he takes a cab to South Bend, I think it was, and then two trolleys, three cabs. The cops are pulling him over the whole way. It's a crazy dash, but he makes it to Comiskey Park in time for the sixth inning of a game against the White Sox. And the manager, Miller Huggins, looked at him, was furious with him. He had not been allowed to leave the team. But he could have ended the streak. The manager could have ended the streak, but said, all right, I'll put you in because you're so close to 1,000 in a row. So we put him in and allowed the streak to continue.
High drama. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with John Eisenberg about his most recent book, which is called The Streak, Lou Gehrig, Cal Ripken Jr., and Baseball's Most Historic Record. The book focuses primarily on Lou Gehrig and Cal Ripken Jr., but as we've been just now talking, there are plenty of other notable ballplayers who are discussed in this book, and it's really the whole history of baseball fans' fascination with the streak that is really the heart and soul of this fascinating book. One of the striking differences between Everett Scott and Lou Gehrig, the player who managed to break his record and really shatter it, actually, is the fact that we think of Everett Scott and some of the others who came before them as kind of grinding players who didn't necessarily do anything spectacularly well. In the case of Lou Gehrig, we're talking about, in a sense, a different caliber of baseball player, aren't we?
Well, we sure are. You're talking about one of the great players ever, certainly one of the great offensive players ever. When I interviewed Cal Ripken for this book, Cal said, you know, in some respects, it's almost embarrassing to be held up to the light with Lou Gehrig, because Lou Gehrig was a career 340 hitter. He had 175 RBIs one year, and that's in the same lineup with Babe Ruth, who cleared the bases pretty well himself. So just an amazing player. Was the career Grand Slam leader, career leader in Grand Slams until A-Rod. So fairly recently, one of the great players in history. There was no secret why the Yankees wanted him out there every day.
Right. So in a sense, that makes him really different, because he's not just somebody that sort of hung on and just kept showing up and made his own contribution to the team. I mean, he was a superstar who also showed up game after game after game. And he seems to have appreciated the notion of this streak and was anxious to break this record. At what point and why did this become important to him?
I think it became important to him 5 or 6 years into his career. When he started, he was Babe Ruth took him under his wing and really taught him the ropes, and Gehrig was a kind of a naive kid and looked up to him. They were very different. Ruth was a carouser, and Gehrig was a real mama's boy in bed early. And I think as they got older, Gehrig came to resent Ruth, didn't really appreciate the way he carried on in life. And he also wanted to find some way to separate himself from Ruth. I mean, he was a great ball player, Gehrig, but Ruth was the star. There was no doubt about it. So he sought ways to separate himself from Ruth. He even said this. He said, look, home runs are Babe's thing. I'm going to be RBIs. I'm going to drive in runs. And, you know, I need to be different somehow. And I think another way to do that was to play every day. I think the streak, which did get a lot of attention, the owner of the Yankees, Jacob Rupert, was on record saying, we think this is a great thing. We love seeing it. And really holds the Yankees in a great light. And so Gehrig, without a doubt, after about 5 or 6 years, he wasn't coming out of a game unless he broke his leg or something. I mean, he really wanted to break this record and take it as far as he could.
One of the most interesting things about your account of Lou Gehrig achieving this record streak of 2,130 games, was all of the close calls and sort of near misses, all of the times in which this streak very nearly came to an end. And in some respects, Lou Gehrig ended up in engaging, or and sometimes it would be a manager that might engage in certain tactics that sustained this record in ways that we really don't see with Cal Ripken Jr. In his streak many decades later. Just touch on at least a couple of the instances in which this streak was in very real peril.
Well, there was a day in Detroit when, by far the best example of that, where Gehrig had a bad back, and he woke up one day, was just really hurting. He couldn't get out of bed, and he had broken the record. He'd broken Scott's record. He owned the record, and he said, well, I just don't think I can play today. But the Yankees, the manager, Joe McCarthy, the trainer, Doc Painter, they said, we want you to play. You should play. Keep the streak going. And so they got him in a cab. They got him to the ballpark. They dressed him. And he hobbled. They wrote out a lineup with Gehrig, first baseman, the famous first baseman, playing shortstop and batting first. And so they're in Detroit. He hobbles to the plate. The first batter of the game, the pitcher throws him a pitch. And, of course, because he's a great hitter, he singles. He can barely stand up, but he gets a base hit. And he staggers to first base, and the Yankees take him out. And McCarthy takes him out, and that is his day at the ballgame. That's how he extended his streak. It takes one at-bat, or back then, you know, any sort of appearance on the field, you extended your streak. And so he did this a number of times, not quite like that. They didn't jigger the lineup for him, but, you know, a pinch-hitting appearance or a half-inning of defense, a number of ways that did not include a full day on the ball field. Gehrig did that 40 or 50 times during his streak because he might have been injured or tired or whatever, especially as he got older. He took that route a lot.
Well, And to be clear, this is not always something that he would do, but sometimes this would be a decision or a choice that a manager might do. I suppose in some cases the line is blurred in terms of who did what, but one way or another, yep, this streak was sustained.
That's correct, yes. And intentions are always very interesting. It's an undercurrent of this book, you know, who cared the most. Was it Gehrig? Was it the team? I do think Gehrig did care. I mean, he didn't mind if the team wanted to keep his streak going. And back then, it just was like, fine, if they want to do that, the attitude towards it was, it didn't really diminish from his talents, or I guess that's the word, as an Iron Man. You know, they thought, well, he's still available almost all the time. He's a great ball player. He's durable. And if he takes a shortcut now and then, it's not a big deal. That was the approach back then.
Right. So it was in August of 1933 that Lou Gehrig played his 1,308th consecutive game, which meant that he broke the record held by Everett Scott. Do I remember correctly that Mr. Scott was on hand for an occasion that had to have caused him a little bit of pain?
No, he was not on hand. He sent his regrets that he could not make it. Everett Scott became a national caliber bowler. And so he was at some bowling congress.
That's right. He was invited but was not able to come.
Couldn't make it.
And that would have probably been a hard thing for him to watch from the stands. And What's intriguing, of course, is that in a sense the strike is nowhere near, or the streak is nowhere near over, that that Lou Gehrig is not about to stop. Although maybe other players might have gone on a little longer and then let it go. This is obviously something to which he hung on really tenaciously.
Yes. You're talking about Scott or Gehrig?
No, now Lou Gehrig. I mean, once he had broken Everett Scott's record, he wanted to sustain this streak as long as he could.
No doubt about it. And I think his relationship with Ruth had something to do with it. Once Babe Ruth was done with baseball, he really ripped Gehrig in public comments, saying, "I don't know why Lou is doing that. It doesn't make sense to me. The Yankees aren't going to pay him to play every day. He's going to hurt himself, shorten his career." Gehrig was furious about it, and they didn't speak until Gehrig became ill near the end of his life. And so Gehrig, without a doubt, said, "I'm going to play every day to prove Babe wrong." And he flat out said, "I think I can push this thing to 2,500 games. I'm going to go for it." Hmm. So, yes, there was no doubt he was going to play every day.
Right. It's in the middle of, I think, the 1938 season that there are the first signs that something is wrong with Lou Gehrig. I know nearly all of our listeners, I'm sure, know about the sad end to Lou Gehrig's career. But your book really helps us kind of understand just how painful and bewildering and abrupt this decline was. Try to give us some sense of just when things began to go wrong for Lou Gehrig and how wrong they went.
I have to say, I performed a lot of my research at the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, New York. They have a great research library and tremendous amount of stuff on Gehrig, including Mrs. Gehrig's scrapbooks. And you can go through there and read all the news accounts and the things that she kept. And it is just the saddest thing you can imagine. I mean, you know, we're many decades removed now, and there's been hokey Hollywood movies about it, and it's become sort of a fable. But when you read it in real time, it's just desperately sad, because he's this great, dependable, strong player who finally starts, his talents start to ebb a little, and people kind of wonder what's going on, and maybe it's just age. And he gets through the 38th season. He reports to spring training in 39, and he's really losing it. He can't play defense very well anymore, simple plays. And it's really baffling. And he can't deliver in the clutch anymore. He can't hit. And finally, very early in that season, he takes himself out of the lineup one day. He said, "I just can't. I'm not helping the team here." He didn't look well. People didn't know what was going on. And so he kind of, after he ended the streak, which was sad for all involved, he hung around the team, traveled with him for another month. He thought maybe he was going to get better. He just had no idea. And then he goes to the Mayo Clinic, and it's determined that he has ALS and that he's not going to live a long time, and it's just a horrible life sentence, although he also thought he was going to beat it at first. So little was known about the disease. And he ended up living just two more years. And so it's just desperately sad, I have to say, researching this and trying to convey it in the book. Just it's really one of the saddest stories of 20th century America, if you ask me.
Absolutely.
What happened to Lou Gehrig.
No question about it. I want you to describe the scene at that game. That would be in, I guess, May of, now is it 1939, when Lou Gehrig approaches Mr. McCarthy and, in a sense, benches himself. Describe what happened in that ensuing game.
Well, they're back in Detroit again, where he almost ended the streak with a bad back. He's in the lobby of the hotel the morning of a game, and he approaches Joe McCarthy and says, "We need to talk." And they go up to McCarthy's hotel room, and Gehrig sets it out straight. He says, "Take me out. I'm hurting the team." And I think McCarthy, as he admitted later, was relieved, because he thought Gehrig was going to get hurt out on the ball field. He couldn't really field anymore. I mean, you know, ALS was taking over his body. And so just an awful thing. And so McCarthy goes back downstairs and announces it to the press, who's hanging around in the lobby. And it just goes from there. So Gehrig goes to the ballpark. He dresses. He takes out the lineup card. The PA announcer says, you know, he's benching himself today. There's an ovation. And the Yankees go out and win the game 22-2. It was almost like they were angry at fate. And so, but Gehrig, he never played again for the Yankees. That was it. Once he benched himself after that day, never on the field again.
Did he remain their captain?
I believe his captaincy, that's a good question. I don't even know that. You've stumped me with that one, but he was no longer with the team on a daily basis after about early June. So
right.
he was the captain. It was a formality.
Right. Best. And never really took the field again after benching himself. What a moment in Major League Baseball, and a tragic end to an amazing career. We're speaking with John Eisenberg, talking about his book, The Streak, Lou Gehrig, Cal Ripken Jr., and baseball's most historic record. So the record of Lou Gehrig stands for many, many decades. It is not broken until 1995. But there are other Iron Men who make the attempt, or at least have the dream of achieving similar streaks. And you talk to just about all of them. Maybe just choose one or two of your most memorable encounters with some of these baseball superstars who had streaks of their own that nevertheless did not end up approaching what Lou Gehrig achieved.
Well, Steve Garvey is definitely one that I found memorable. He is still the National League record holder. I mean, Gehrig and Ripken both were American Lakers. Garvey set the National League record playing for the Dodgers and the San Diego Padres in the 70s and 80s, 1,206 straight games. And he was just unabashed. I want Gehrig's record. He thought it was one of the great achievements in sports history, and he thought he had a chance to do it. And he did take an occasional pinch hitting appearance and things, but mostly was on the field. He was with the Dodgers and then went to the Padres as a free agent. And the Padres were going to let him play. They were sort of a team struggling, and they really were glad to have him. And they were going to let him go as long as he could. And he thinks he could have gotten pretty close, Steve Garvey. But he broke his thumb sliding into home, trying to score a run. And when I interviewed him 30 years later, he's still depressed about it because he thinks he could have gotten pretty close. He really does. He was about 7 years of games away. He was 32, still a pretty good ball player, so not impossible, and kept himself in great shape. He could have made it, but all these years later, he says it's his greatest achievement in baseball, and this is a guy who won World Series and was a National League MVP and home run champion, all these things, but he's proudest of having played in 1,206 straight games.
Hmm. Someone else who was also an impressive Iron Man was Billy Williams. What was his relationship to the streak?
He was, I think, tortured by it would be the best way. Garvey broke his record. Williams, of course, great outfielder, steady hitter, producer for the Chicago Cubs for many years. And even reading his quotes in real time was so interesting. Even while he was doing it, he would say, you know, I'm not sure why. I'm not sure this is a good idea. I can't believe I'm doing this. But I am doing it because it's in my DNA, really, to be out there. I can't stand to not be out there, so I'm out there. And he played in, let's see, it was 1,117 straight games. Garvey broke his record. And he finally took himself out and said, this needs to end. I'm running out of gas here, basically, is what he said. Maybe it was all those day games at Wrigley Field. But he was running out of gas and decided that it's better to give yourself a break now and then.
Before we get to Mr. Ripken, I also want you to make mention of an intriguing Japanese player that you talk about who achieves quite an impressive streak of his own.
Yes, well, he was the world record holder. There's actually Japanese baseball, sort of the approach is very team oriented, and it's a little different approach, and it sets up well for Iron Man streaks. You do what the manager says. There's less individualism, and if the manager wants to play him, you play. And so, yeah, there was this third baseman and first baseman, Sachio Kinugasa, for the Hiroshima Carp, who was a great player and an Iron Man and played in more games than Gehrig and broke Gehrig's record. And in Japan, they celebrated him when he did that and wound up playing in, I think it was 2,215 games in a row, something like that.
Right, I think so.
And And so it was, yeah, well, I mean, Ripken wound up breaking his record, and they met each other, not to get ahead of the story, and wound up being friends. They're still friends. But Kinugasa is the Japanese Ironman.
Right. And, of course, that's not a name that's nearly as familiar to any of us as the names of Lou Gehrig and Cal Ripken,
right,
and the other folks we've
right.
been talking about. Is there any reason for us not to venerate his streak as much as these other streaks that we are talking about? I mean, is it an equal, comparable achievement?
Absolutely. All right. It's different in the sense the Japanese season is only 130 games. So it's a Gehrig, Ripken played in 162 every year, so 30 fewer games is a significant amount. Because the core task of any streak is to play a full season of games, and then you can go take a nap. But Kinugasa, so 130 games, a little less, but nonetheless, it's the same thing, day in and day out playing, and he got hit. He's hit by pitch all the time and played with injuries, so very much the same thing, no question about it.
We're speaking with John Eisenberg and talking about his book called The Streak. At last, we reach the name of Cal Ripken Jr., a player that, of course, you had a very deep connection with because of the fact that you covered the Baltimore Orioles for so many, many years, and that's, of course, where he made his baseball home. Ahead of us talking about what Cal Ripken achieved, tell our listeners a little bit about him, about his background, and maybe even a brief word about his baseball pedigree.
Well, he is a baseball lifer. He grew up in the game. His father played for the Orioles minor league system and then became a coach, a manager, a developmental guy for decades, and then ultimately a major league coach, briefly the manager. So 50 years in baseball, close to 50 years. So Cal grew up, his father, every summer they would go to wherever Cal Sr. was managing, whether it be in Asheville, North Carolina, or who knows where, somewhere, some little dot on the map. And they grew up going to the ballpark and watching their dad plow the infield and make out the lineup, throw batting practice, drive the bus, do everything. So Cal grew up with baseball in his blood. And as he got older, his father, and became a prospect, his father definitely imparted to him a philosophy. I mean, you know, there was a way to be a ball player if you were going to do this. You get to the park early, you take infield, you take batting practice, you have your head in the game, and if the manager wants you to play, you play. Keep your head down and all that. And so Cal definitely came into professional baseball with a mindset that, if at all possible, you should play. And so that's where he came from, and it had a big impact, needless to say, on his the way he approached baseball.
What were his greatest gifts as a baseball player besides longevity and durability?
Well, I would say two things. Number one, physically imposing, powerful guy that gets lost in the shuffle. Ken Singleton, a former teammate, said probably the strongest player I ever played with. And one of his former teammates, Mickey Tettleton, the catcher who played with and against Cal, I asked him, what was it like sliding into second when Cal was turning the double play? Mickey said it was like sliding into a tree. So just a big, strong guy that definitely was an asset. And the other thing I think was his analytical approach, his mind. He's very philosophical, he's an analytical guy. That's just the way he approached things. He would always analyze any situation, and it helped him learn how to use his body, say, around second base, and keep himself out of harm's way. And just he was just a smart ball player is really what it comes down to. And so he carried himself in a lot of ways that enabled him to avoid injury.
What kind of relationship did he have with Baltimore and with the Orioles organization?
Well, the Orioles supported him. I mean, Baltimore, they loved him. He grew up in Aberdeen, Maryland, just north of Baltimore. He's a local kid. So he was beloved from the beginning, the son of a coach, and just everything about him. He was the wholesome, all-American kid. Didn't want to get out of the lineup, and what was there not to love? As soon as he got to Baltimore, he was Rookie of the Year, and then American League MVP and World Series champion. That's in his first 2 years. So just from the get-go, a hero. And so that never really changed. He was a hero here. And the Orioles just loved him. They loved having him around. What was there not to love? So, you know, he was as popular as it gets.
He achieved his streak, in a sense, in a cleaner fashion than Lou Gehrig did. That's one of the kind of intriguing comparisons between the two, that Cal Ripken seemed really determined to, in a sense, not cut any corners in preserving this streak. Is that fair to say?
It is. That's the biggest difference in these two streaks, I think. They're both, believe me, I am in no way disparaging Lou Gehrig, but Cal's streak was pure, purer one. He started all 2,632 straight games, started them with the intention of playing nine innings. He got tossed out of a few, got pitch hit for a few times. The vast majority of the time, he played to the end. There was none of that corner cutting and things like that. Not a DH. You know, he was there to play ball.
And right. So, none of these sort of token appearances. He was always, I mean, he was generally speaking, started a game and finished a game through this whole streak.
It's the biggest difference, if you ask me. It's the separator between his streak and Gehrig's streak.
There were a couple of moments when this streak was in fairly significant peril. Especially when it came to trying to achieve it cleanly. Probably one of them was that seriously sprained ankle. Was it 1985?
Right. He sprained an ankle the second game of the 85 season, and fortunately the Orioles had a day off the next day, so he was able to treat it and give himself about 48 hours to get it under control, and he did, and so he was able to play. That was a close one. And the other close call, he was in a brawl. The Orioles and the Mariners, right after Camden Yards opened the second year, had just a huge brawl on a Sunday afternoon, and Ripken was on the bottom of the pile, and he comes out of it with a twisted knee. And the next morning, he finishes that game. The next morning, he can barely walk. He can't put any weight on it. And he thought it was over that day. He said, I can't put weight on my leg. I'm in trouble here. But again, he went to the park, he took treatment, and it turned out it wasn't a ligament tear or anything. It was something you could treat. And so by that night, he was able to get on the field and play. And it was a very close call to hear him tell the story. But, you know, it came out on the right side of things.
Cal Ripken was, by and large, a very consistent player and a great player, but he had patches that were rough. During this streak, how much criticism did he have to endure during those rough patches? I mean, how many naysayers were there who said, you're caring about this streak more than you're caring about the Orioles?
There were a lot. There were a lot of naysayers. Cal told me when I interviewed him, he says his recollection of games 1300 through 1800, the streak, his recollection of that time is pretty much all negative because he was taking a lot of heat. The Orioles were losing. They were in a rebuilding period, and everything looks bad when that's happening to a ball club. And people will say, well, why is he out there playing every day? What do we need that for? And he was hitting .210 at times, as was the case 1 year at the All-Star break. So he took a lot of heat, and that's certainly something Gehrig didn't deal with. Of course, Gehrig was never hitting .210, but so Cal dealt with quite a bit of criticism, and just he obviously just felt differently, and as did the managers who continued to put him out there. He always felt even if he wasn't hitting, there was something he could do to help the Orioles win. His defense was great. He altered how other people were pitched to, in his leadership just a number of ways that he could help them, and the managers kept putting him out there.
I'm no baseball fan, but I was in front of my television set the night that he broke this record, September 6, 1995, and I know all kinds of Americans were, whether you loved baseball or not, it was hard not to be drawn there. And of course, it's especially interesting. It's unlike when Hank Aaron broke the home run record. You never knew when that was going to happen. But there was this colossal sense of anticipation because, barring him being hit by a train or something, everybody knew that night this record, this amazing record, was going to be broken. What are your recollections of that historic occasion?
Well, I was there that night. I wrote a column for the Baltimore Sun and had a front row seat literally in the press box, and so I had a great view. It's probably the greatest thing I ever covered, most memorable night. And, yes, everyone knew it was happening. There was a great air of anticipation, years in the making. And what was the president of the United States was there, Bill Clinton. The vice president was there, Al Gore. Joe DiMaggio was there. The Orioles had invited him. He had teamed with Gehrig early in DiMaggio's career, late in Gehrig's career. They were teammates. They invited him to come, and he came and gave an eloquent speech. So, you just felt like you were at the center of the universe. And Ripken, of course, what most fans remember from that night is after the game was official and he'd broken the record, fans cheered so long that the game couldn't restart. It was the middle of the fifth inning, and finally his teammates pushed him out, and they said, "Why don't you go shake hands with the fans or something, do something so we can play this game eventually." And he winds up circling the field and just an organic celebration, totally impromptu, shaking hands with just the fans. 22-minute delay in the game. We'll never see it again.
Right.
And this amazing celebration took place.
And for those of us not fortunate enough to be there in person, it was nearly as dramatic to watch it on television, in part because ESPN went without a commercial for that long, long ovation. And my recollection is they didn't say a word either. I mean, I've never seen anything like it. I mean, that long, where the announcer stayed silent and we were just allowed to take in that amazing scene. And of course, Cal Ripken's remarks were so beautifully eloquent, especially the opening words: "Tonight I stand here overwhelmed as my name is linked with the great and courageous Lou Gehrig." Incredible. So, is it even worth it to try to compare these two streaks, or is it better for us to just appreciate each of them in their own way, the streaks of Lou Gehrig and Cal Ripken Jr.?
I would go for the latter. I posed all this to Cal. It's in the book. We went over it sort of with the different ways you could compare them. He enjoyed the exercise, and it is interesting how you can break them down. I posed the question to Steve Garvey. I call him a neutral arbiter in the case of Ripken versus Gehrig. And he says, you know what, it's pointless to do that. There's so many ways. The reality is they played in different eras under different circumstances. They were the only ones who did what they did. So they both deserve great credit for doing what they did. And I kind of agree with that.
The book, again, is The Streak, Lou Gehrig, Cal Ripken Jr., and baseball's most historic record. And the author, John Eisenberg. John Eisenberg, I congratulate you on yet another superb book. And I hope many people will seek out this book and revisit not only the amazing streaks of Lou Gehrig and Cal Ripken, but this whole long, complex, and fascinating story. And thank you for being part of The Morning Show.
Oh, my pleasure, and I enjoyed being with you again. Thank you.
Next week, we have a lineup of really fun morning show interviews. On Monday, a legend in public radio history, Jack Mitchell, the very first employee of National Public Radio, the first producer of All Things Considered, and a longtime director of Wisconsin Public Radio, is my morning show guest. On Tuesday, we'll learn about the Battle of Leyte Gulf, The largest naval battle in world history and a critical moment in the Second World War. On Wednesday, we will replay a conversation from 20 years ago this summer with a college student, then college student, Casey Holtz, who dove into the waters of Lake Michigan to rescue a young boy who otherwise would have drowned. Next Thursday, a good friend of the morning show returns, Michael Schumacher, talking about his latest book, Too Much Sea for Their